listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at great music from the movies, and you could share your favorite scores and soundtracks. Now, on the surface, you may wonder how this could even be a problem. If you have paid vacation time from work, why wouldn't you use it? Well, it's actually pretty common these days, and we can blame the pandemic, partly. Instead of going on that fun trip to Florida or someplace far away, officials recommend people stay close to home. On top of that, many events and festivities were canceled. Big gatherings with family and friends were also considered a no-no. As a result, people just kept on working. That's one of the reasons, anyway. So all the time off is piling up, and that's got companies worried not just about their employees burning out. It could cost them money down the road. So many businesses are looking for ways to convince their workers to take some time off now. You can tell us about your situation at 800-642-1234. Have you been taking days off during the pandemic? If you have paid vacation time, are you at risk of losing some of it? Was this already the norm at your workplace even pre-pandemic? Or if you have that paid vacation time, do you make sure to use every last drop? And if you're an employer, are you finding yourself having to encourage people to take that time off? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Linda Dunbar is a communications executive in New York City and the founder of Diversity Decoder. That's a service that helps companies navigate through diversity, equity, and inclusion issues. She's written about vacation time. Linda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi there.
How big a problem are you seeing this unused vacation time around the country?
Well, I think that different organizations are doing different things, and people are kind of behaving different ways. So I think that companies are all making a push so that people will take vacation time. Because with COVID, there's a very high awareness that people need, you know, more mental health, and that people need to kind of find ways to break up what they've been doing over COVID, which hasn't always been, you know, totally pleasant to be at home 24 hours a day for some people.
Now, I understand, I've seen studies even pre-2020 that Americans are exceptional, that often we leave vacation time on the table, even without a pandemic. Why does that happen?
Well, I think that it's different by generation. So I think boomers were very much, don't take any vacation time, do what your boss is doing. And if that's not taking vacation, neither are you. But I will say that millennials and Gen Z are much more about vacation and much more about a balanced lifestyle. And so that's why we see more companies really pushing people to take vacation and encouraging it. So it's partly a push and pull, but employers also need people to take vacation because having a bedraggled workforce is not good for anybody.
Let's talk some more about that. We could see why, the workers, the employees can benefit from taking the vacation time. How is it going to help the bottom line for a company to recognize and encourage their employees to use that vacation time?
Well, I think, you know, the first thing is, as I mentioned, having exhausted, burned out employees isn't really good for anybody. Tired employees make mistakes. They're just not engaged. They're not as creative. And I also think there really is a better understanding today that health, physical and mental health, is part of what you bring to work. And that it's important to have all those pieces together. So I think more employees are demanding that. And employers are recognizing that it's important.
Talking to Linda Dunbar, a communications executive. She wrote a piece about vacation time. It turns out a lot of people in the United States don't use their vacation time in normal times. And during the pandemic, there's nowhere to go. Why take vacation time? A lot of people are thinking. And now even some businesses are offering to pay employees to use their vacation time. You could share your story of your paid leave. Have you been using it over the course of the last year? Have you been holding on to it thinking, why take the time off just to sit around at home? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Linda, that piece I referenced you wrote, it was in the Society of Human Resources Management newsletter. And you say that companies can promote vacation time if the people at the top lead by example. What does that look like?
Yes. Well, we all know that if the leadership team is always there, that discourages people from taking time. So really letting people know you're taking the time off if you're in the C-suite or you're a leader, and really unplugging. So if you go on vacation and you are texting people and calling people and emailing people, that's really not good role modeling. So you really need to anticipate what might happen while you're gone, make sure that you have coverage and somebody deputized to handle that, and really unplug. And that will help other people feel that they have permission to unplug too when the time comes.
I think at some places, some workplaces, Linda, there's this mentality, wow, if I take time off and the business doesn't burn down without me, I've just proven successfully that they don't need me. And I think there's some corporate mindsets that kind of says, yeah, if we could do without them on vacation time, why do we need them at all? How do we escape that kind of mindset?
Well, I think that that is really, I think people know that 1 week is different from a year, and 1 week is different from 4 months or 10 years or whatever it is. So I think that people really have to understand that you can kind of hold it together and get the stuff on your, so to speak, desk to hold for a week. But if you're gone for longer than that, if you're gone for 4 months, it's not the same thing. So I think that people really do understand that a week is different from your job not being important. So I think that really, I mean, if you look at other countries, you look at European countries, everybody understands that people need to take a break. And everybody understands that just because you take a vacation doesn't mean that your job is not an important, needed job. But we're all human beings, and we all work better if we have time off.
Now, to that person over this last year in the pandemic, looking at the employee now, Linda, who says, and I'm kind of here, why do I want to take a chunk of time off now just to do nothing during this pandemic if I can't travel? Can you make the case that it is valuable, if we do it right, it is valuable to still use that time?
It absolutely is valuable. And I will say that there are a couple of things there. Part of it is, if you're taking time off and you're at home, you have to find a way to make it different. And the key thing is being able to take separation or a break from the day-to-day activities of work. So the organization needs to think about that from both sides. And that is, if somebody is going to take time, which you want them to do, you need to make sure that you are not bothering them all the time, right? So you need to think about, well, what needs to be covered while that person is out? And what can we just wait a week or two to do? And everybody has to also do that for each other. So one of the great things about working at a company collaboratively is that you can help each other. On a short term, just to cover while somebody's on a break or needs to take some time. From the employee point of view, really making sure that you're not checking your email every 5 minutes, that you're not taking calls, that you're not calling other people or sending out emails is a really important thing. And I will say that companies are becoming more international now. So we're starting to learn from our colleagues in other countries how to take a break. Because in other countries, not all other countries, but certain other countries, that is what they do, and they are not apologetic about it. So I think for people who work in companies that are international, they're learning from their colleagues what vacation really is.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Rich is with us in Green Bay. Rich, hi. Are you there, Rich? Rich, I hear you moving there. All right, maybe we'll try you again in a few moments. We'll take a little break now. We're talking about why Americans are reluctant to use their vacation time during the pandemic. Linda Dunbar is with us, communications executive in New York City, founder of Diversity Decoder. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been taking time off over the last year, even if it means just staying at home? Or are you letting vacation days pile up? Do you have vacation days? If you don't, do you wish you did? If you run a business as an owner, manager at a workplace, How do you encourage your employees to take a break? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're looking at why many American workers haven't been taking days off during the pandemic, even when they have that paid leave time. That's got some companies worried about employee burnout, and unused vacation time can be a liability for them. We've seen some creative solutions to help workers use that time off, even bonuses for using your leave time. Linda Dunbar stays with us. She's a communications executive in New York City and founder of Diversity Decoder. She's written about this issue, and you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences as a worker or employer or your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Lucas is with us in Jefferson. Lucas, hi.
Hi. Nice to talk to you. I work at a company in Madison, and we actually switched over from a policy of PTO to a policy of FTO, which stands for free time off. And basically, it's an unlimited time off system where it takes away the alleviation of workers having a certain amount of time per year to take off. And basically, they can take off whenever they want to, as long as they get their work done. And I think it really has helped alleviate that problem of people not being able to take off time or feeling like they can't take off time, so they can take it off whenever they want to.
And Lucas, I think people might be suspicious, like, well, wait, doesn't that mean you're just going to take tons of time, too much time off? Has it worked out that way, though?
No, it really only applies to salaried workers at my company. Mm-hmm. So nobody that works by the hour. But people have pretty much been pretty good by it. And I feel like people have taken more time off than they usually have because, like you said, people don't like to take PTO off and they end up at the end of the year with way too many hours.
Interesting. Lucas, thanks a lot for sharing that. I've heard that notion before. Linda, is that something you've encountered, that idea of free time off, get your job done, and yeah, just cut out when you need to?
You know, I think we're seeing that more and more. I have a client now that that's their policy in the U.S., and it seems to be working.
Thanks a lot for that call. And the incentive structure there is interesting, because I guess if we have this paid time off and this finite resource called vacation time, we might want to hoard it for when we really need it. With that free time off attitude, that pressure isn't there. Is there something to that, do you think, Linda?
Yeah, because I will say that hoarding is also, vacation hoarding is an issue where you will find that nobody takes the time off. And then in December, everybody's gone because they didn't, because they have to take it then. And I don't think that's good for workflow. And so I don't think anybody really, really wants to do that. I will say that one of the things that I've come across is that a company, I don't know if you know Indeed, but they have something called Day U, and they give one mental health day every month. And it's the same day by region, so that everybody takes the same time off. And somebody who was taking a mental health day at another company mentioned to me, they said, well, you know, it's not a mental health day if I get back and I have a million things on my desk, because mm-hmm. everybody's been sending things while I've been gone. And I never really thought of it that way. But I think this kind of idea of just give everybody a day a month together, that also kind of lowers the stress levels, because you don't have to worry about what people have been doing while you've been gone, right?
Thanks a lot for that call, Lucas, at 800-642-1234. Found out what Rich had wanted to call in about. He says a lot of companies are turning to contract workers and kind of outsourcing things. And the people who work in those kind of contracts don't often have the same access to vacation time as maybe the full-time employees. And there are a lot of workplaces, Linda, that I think don't have paid time off like this, paid vacation time. Do you want to see more companies have at least something, whatever form it takes?
Oh, I think yes. I think it's very important. One, because people have things they need to get done outside of their work lives. But two, it's very important for being, for, you know, for having a workforce that's creative, and also a workforce that's that's loyal and dedicated. If you're, you know, if you are frazzled and stressed out, you don't really, that's not a place you want to come to, right? If you know, a place that doesn't give you a chance to kind of rejuvenate. So I think making sure that people are refreshed and ready to bring their best selves to work, however you can make that happen policy-wise, is important.
We are talking about paid vacation time and why many people in the United States don't use it. And during the pandemic, even more so, a lot of people holding off on using that vacation time. Linda Dunbar is with us, communication executive in New York. She wrote a piece on this for the Society of Human Resources Management. Still time for your calls with your questions and experiences at 800-642-1234. Linda, earlier you were talking about the importance of when you're on vacation, actually being on vacation, not doing your work, not emailing, not contacting. Is there a lesson there for even when we're not on vacation, our normal work day and that temptation in the evening to, you know, do the emails or Slack or whatever it might be to keep up with the job when we're off the clock?
Yeah, I think that to the extent that you can, you need to try to wrap it up by a certain time. And I think also getting clear with the people you work with, because I know one thing that happens is some people are clearing their emails at night. So they'll just get a few things off. And then the people who receive them are like, well, am I supposed to be answering this? Like, am I supposed to be on here at 10 o'clock? So if you know that the other person, hey, I just do this, you know, don't worry about it, it's relaxing for me. When you're receiving it, you can know, okay, I can turn off my cell phone and I don't have to look at this until tomorrow, and it's okay. I will say that in France, they have a law that you cannot email employees after a certain time of day. I don't think for American culture that that necessarily is something that we would do, but it's interesting to know that some governments take that seriously enough that they've actually legislated that.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Presque Isle. John, hi.
How are you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, John?
Well, I worked for a company that had a very interesting vacation schedule in that there was no vacation, no holidays, no sick days, nothing. But you were required to work a set number of hours for the full year, and that's how it worked.
For the whole year. And did that set number of hours mean you had to work 50 hours a week, John, or was it a something you could do way?
No, it was 52 to 54, 52 weeks a year. 52 hours a week, 52 weeks a year.
Oh, so that sounds like it would be really hard to get a vacation in then.
Well, most of the people at corporate were liars. They over-reported their hours.
Ah, okay.
They would say things, I would gripe about it, and they'd say things, well, Johnny, you're reporting all of your hours, you know. And I think they were basically telling us the lie.
But, interesting.
It was a large survey corporation that you all heard of on the news.
Interesting. John, thanks a lot for that call. Yeah, that seems like a weird incentive structure, Linda. Yeah, we're going to set up this unreasonable way to measure your hours and encourage you to lie about them? Go ahead, Linda.
I just think it's interesting, one, why you'd want to do that. And I'm wondering, I don't know if John is still there, but I'm wondering if that was a few years ago, because now I think companies are more and more aware of their recruitment brand, and they're more aware that if their employees who now have social media and many other things that they will just go out with whenever they feel like it. So, you know, you have to think about what your recruitment brand is and how you handle vacation and time off is an important part of that. And now if people don't like what they're experiencing, they will go right off this glass door, social media, wherever it is that they want to go, and be very clear about how they feel about it.
John, thanks a lot for that call. And Linda, can you talk more about that again on the employer side of things? the benefits of having good benefits for their workers in terms of, you know, who they recruit and who they retain for the long haul?
Well, I think it's very, you know, now that we're in this world where investors have said that they want companies to have purpose and an understanding of kind of why they exist, and a world where they've also said making employees and customers happy is part of what investors want to see, combined with a millennial workforce that has values about work-life balance. I think all of that adds up to having to be really conscious of how you treat employees and how that relates to getting other employees into the system and getting people to come and stay, right? And when you combine that with diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, you know, that's something that you have to really get all the pieces together on, because people want to feel like they can go to, you know, bringing your whole self to work is a new concept. But that's an important concept and people expect that. And so if they feel like they, you know, part of the brand is being at work 24 hours a day, that is not going to work. And something I found really interesting is apparently recently the analysts at Goldman Sachs got together and said that they felt, and this is investment banking where everybody, you know, traditionally you work 100 hours a week, and if you can work more than that, you do, and hopefully at the end of 7 years you're rich, right? So, but the analysts got together and said, we're overworked, we've done a survey, so we have surveyed each other, here is the data on the survey on slides presented the way you would present slides to clients, and they shared this. So that's a whole new paradigm where employees are getting together and saying, this is not acceptable. We've collected data, okay? And now we're going to share the data with management because we want change.
Linda, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
Linda Dunbar is a communications executive in New York City and the founder of Diversity Decoder. We talked to her about why workers are reluctant to use vacation time, especially during the pandemic, and how companies are pushing their employees to take time off. You can keep the conversation going on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know if you've been using your vacation days or not, or if your workplace has you asking, what are these vacation days you're talking about? Do you not have that kind of paid time off? Do you wish you did? Share your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about movies and music ahead of this weekend's Academy Awards. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. That's a piece from the 1958 French film Elevator to the Gallows, performed by jazz legend Miles Davis. Music plays a huge role in movies. It helps evoke certain emotions, like happy or sad, or some of the other ones I've heard of. And filmmakers rely on music, either through a soundtrack or original score, to bring the audience along on the journey. With the Oscars coming up this weekend, we wanted to take a closer look at the music that has made the movies, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is there a song, score, or soundtrack that's memorable to you? Do you listen to movie music outside of the movie? Do you find some new music to listen to from watching a movie? Do you like soundtracks or scores better? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or share your favorites on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillis is an associate professor of English and film studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She wrote the book, The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship, and Modernized American Theater Architecture. Jocelyn, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. I just said score or soundtrack. What's the difference?
Sure. Well, a score is really is all instrumental music generally written for the movie. And generally speaking, soundtracks are songs, often pop songs at this point. The main way we can think about the difference between the two is that none of the characters in the universe of the film, what we would call the diegesis, none of them can hear the score. The score is just there for the pleasure of the audience and for the audience to experience some kind of emotional journey, to heighten the emotion in a particular moment in time. But the soundtrack, you know, it might be playing in a car while characters are driving along. It might be playing in a club. It can be something that's either a part of the narrative or not a part of the narrative.
Now, you have mentioned to our producer that music has gone along with movies since even before movies had sound. Can you tell us about those early days?
Yeah, I think it's so important to understand that there is this deep, deep connection between the image and music, really since the nascence of cinema. So in the silent era, of course, there's no music coming from the movie itself, but that doesn't mean there wasn't music happening in the moment. From a very, very early moment, there are various kinds of instruments being played in the movie theater, especially things like upright pianos. But the most important instrument that we associate with the silent era is, of course, the organ. And the organ has just a pretty interesting history. Robert Hope Jones is the person who popularized the organ in the movie theater. And he was an English organ maker who started off making organs for churches in the UK. And then he thought, well, this is such an amazing instrument that can convey all of the power and might and majesty of an entire orchestra, but that can all be located in a single instrument. So he actually moves to the United States and popularizes placing organs in movie theaters. I think that says a lot about how we think about the connections between a kind of mystical, spiritual experience in a church and in the movie theater as well. Wurlitzer eventually buys his company, but that's the person that we can credit with the organ in the movie theater.
And then movies get sound and we can have songs inside of movies. Let's hear one famous example from back in the 1930s. Here it is.
Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I heard of.
So Jocelyn, there's kind of another category, score, soundtrack, and then here's a person actually singing the music within the movie.
That's right. And of course, as sound enters film production at the very end of the 1920s and into the 1930s, that becomes a real possibility. Musicals, of course, take off because you can now have people singing and dancing in the film. But that's such a wonderful example, Somewhere Over the Rainbow, which not only has this amazing kind of emotional wallop in the moment, but becomes forever associated with Judy Garland. So it's a song that has really lasting legacies, even outside the actual text of the film.
Now, here's another one that can evoke powerful emotions of a very different sort than Somewhere Over the Rainbow, one that you like, and I've talked to the composer on this very show. Here's a listen to a scarier one. So that's the theme from Halloween by director and soundtrack composer John Carpenter, and I was lucky enough, a high point in my Radiotronic career, I interviewed John Carpenter about his movie music, which was a blast. Can you talk about a strange character like John Carpenter?
I am so totally jealous of that, Rob, because I am such a huge John Carpenter fan. I actually saw him perform his synth scores in Milwaukee a couple years ago.
Okay, now I'm jealous of you. I missed that.
It was awesome. Yeah, he's such a kind of unique figure in terms of the integration of the music and the image, because as you mentioned, he wrote his own synthesizer scores for his movies. And this is not normal. This is not normal. So he does it for Halloween, which is probably the most famous of his scores, but also for The Fog and The Thing. He has this kind of amazing history of doing that. They're thought of as kind of cheesy for a while, but then we see in a more contemporary kind of art horror mode, a resurgence of interest in the synth score. So movies like It Follows or The Guest, other kinds of recent horror movies that are interested in the history of horror, they end up going back to the John Carpenter style of synthesizer horror scores. It's really, really interesting that he moves from being thought of as kind of outré, a little bit antiquated, to something that people then recognize as very, very useful for heightening the suspense and thrill of a horror movie.
We are talking about movie music, soundtrack scores, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your favorites. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is with us from UW-Milwaukee. Let's go to your calls now. Mark is with us in Wauwatosa. Mark, hello.
Hello. For me, Star Wars, the music by John Williams just made that movie. It would have been just a so-so, you know, space science fiction flick if it hadn't been for that wonderful soundtrack by John Williams.
Yeah, that's a great win. And Jocelyn, this is kind of a lifetime achievement award there. John Williams, Star Wars and Indiana Jones movies and so many more. Can you talk about him a little bit?
Yeah, I think he's certainly the person that we think about when we think about the power of the score. The one that I always think about is actually in Jurassic Park.
Oh, yeah.
The moment where everybody sees the brontosauruses for the first time, and it's so thrilling. But that moment means nothing without the presence of that really overpowering, really, really powerful music, that it really, it creates a sense of wonder in the audience that the image alone cannot fully achieve.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mark. I appreciate it. Are there soundtracks, Jocelyn, that you just like listen to, you know, just for the heck of it, even detached from the movie itself?
Yeah, the ones that I do would be kind of imbued with a sense of nostalgia. This is going to sound so silly, but when my husband and I first met, he had a Corolla that only had a tape deck, and we only had one tape, and it was the single soundtrack. And I'm a child of the 90s, so it's actually the single soundtrack, just because I think of going on road trips and hearing Pearl Jam over and over and over again.
Interesting. Okay. The single soundtrack. Well, how about you? Is there something that you like to listen to from a movie, even without the movie attached to it? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to check out another one now. Ennio Morricone, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. We'll maybe give a little listen to that in a minute. But Darren on Facebook pointed toward that one, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Morricone passed away last summer, and his music so key to so many Western films and others. And actually, a buddy of mine, speaking of listening, did a little compilation that he called Songs for Smoking and Gun Toting that I still listen to this day. Can you talk a little bit about Ennio Morricone, Jocelyn?
That is the greatest title of a mix ever. Yeah, Morricone had the most incredibly long career. It's really striking. And of course, he's Italian and then works with Sergio Leone for doing these kinds of like spaghetti westerns in the U.S. The Western itself in the 50s and then in the 60s when Morricone is working on their scores, that actually is a place that we can point to, a particular genre we can point to that has a really notable history in terms of the integration of the sound and the image. Western scores became so very, very popular, partially due to people like Morricone. But he also worked on just an abundance of other films. One of my personal favorites that he wrote the score for is Gillo Pontecorvo's The Battle of Algiers from 1966, which is a pretty tremendous political film. So just a really incredible long career.
We're talking to Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies right now about music and the movies ahead of the Oscars this weekend. She's an associate professor of English and film studies at UW-Milwaukee. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What are some of your favorite movie soundtracks and scores? Which ones do you think have been underappreciated? What kind of emotions or feelings do songs bring to you in the movies? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're hearing the song Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, from the 1983 movie of the same name, starring late David Bowie, about an English soldier captured by Japanese forces during World War II. Mentioned by Tim on the Ideas Network Facebook page as one of his favorite movie scores. We're talking about movies and music right now ahead of the Academy Awards. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies stays with us, assistant associate professor of English and Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee, and you at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite movie music? 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go back to your calls now. Rusty is with us in Dalton. Rusty, hi.
Hi. Well, way back in the 70s when I was in college, I took a course on film and so forth. And one of the things that we concentrated on was Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. Ooh. And the music for that is just it's just some violin screeching music, and it's sheer terror. Now, and they put a lot of time into that, and that was what I wanted to comment on.
Rusty, thank you so much. And that, I feel like, Jocelyn, even if people haven't seen the movie Psycho, they've heard the violin thing that Rusty is talking about.
Oh my gosh, yes, that is, that everybody knows exactly that that piece of music. And that is another piece of music that's so inextricably tied to the scene in which it occurs. And just to note, this isn't really about the music, but it is about the sound effect of the stabbing in the shower, right? The stabbing of Janet Leigh in the shower. What they used to create that kind of sound was a stabbing into a melon. So it kind of fits with the shrieking violins. You have the moment in time, and then the horror of the violins, and then the horror of the sound of what is actually just a knife being stabbed into a melon. But it all works through the power of cinematic illusion.
I did that for a radio drama once, but it was a pumpkin. I stabbed a pumpkin repeatedly. I was my own Foley guy for a radio thing I did years and years ago. It worked pretty well. The melon probably would have been better. Thanks a lot for that call. Let's go to Jeannie now in Waupaca. Jeannie, hi.
Hi. I have a question. You know, you're talking about movies and films. Would it be considered a score or soundtrack when you're talking about, you know, animations like the old Tom and Jerry, where, you know, there was no speaking, it was all music?
Jeannie, thanks a lot. Now, a lot of those had scores, and I think a lot of them just, like, grabbed some random classical music, too. I don't know, Jocelyn, do you have thoughts on our cartoon musics?
Yeah, I mean, we would describe those as scores, and you're right, Rob, that a lot of them would use just kind of something that was sort of more public domain. You could just kind of slap onto the cartoon. But one of my favorite examples, and I teach the history of animation, I always teach this cartoon because it's my favorite Warner Brothers cartoon, is That's Opera Doc, we have Bugs Bunny and Elmer Fudd doing the standard, you know, run and chase each other, but it's all set to a kind of pseudo Wagner opera, and it's absolutely hilarious. It's poking fun of the opera music, but also of the repetition of Elmer Fudd and Bugs Bunny continually engaging in this cycle of violence. It's just wonderful.
Thanks a lot for that call. Travis on Facebook says, every single movie by Wes Anderson is driven by incredible soundtracks. To pick one would be next to impossible. No problem, Travis. We picked one for you. This is from The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, Sio Georges, and I'm mispronouncing it probably. He covered a lot of David Bowie songs. Here's a great one, Life on Mars.
Se o poder vem do sol, minha medida, então vem.
Wow, I forgot how good that was. I think I recall that David Bowie was a fan of these covers of his work to Jocelyn. Any thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah, that's great. I think about also a kind of similar moment, but in the wonderful Pedro Almodovar film Talk to Her, where there's this brief concert that happens, and it's Caetano Veloso, the great Brazilian singer-songwriter, singing Cucuru Cucu Paloma, and it is just a magical, magical sequence. But another moment where a very respected and renowned singer-songwriter is performing, and it's just a moment of heavy, heavy emotional import.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Doug is with us in Lancaster. Doug, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a comment and a shameless plug. My comment is there are two directors out right now that I just think are perfect with integrating music and scenes, Quentin Tarantino and Martin Scorsese. There are certain songs that come on the air that I hear that take me immediately to scenes within their movies. Secondly, we have a very good friend of mine who I met at camp many years ago in Mequonago. He's from Sheboygan, and he's a producer out in California. He has produced a movie called Original Motion Picture Soundtrack, which if you're a fan of 80s movies, this is for you. He has interviewed people like Danny Elfman, Kevin Bacon, Corey Feldman, all the major composers of a lot of the popular songs that were out during 80s movies. It's a must-see. I'm not sure where you could find it right now. And it was released in 2017. I have not seen it on streaming services, but if you can get a chance to see it, get it.
A movie called The Original Motion Picture Soundtrack about motion picture soundtracks. Thanks a lot for sharing that recommendation. He mentioned there, Jocelyn, a couple of directors, Scorsese and Tarantino, for working music into their works.
I am so excited to get to talk about Scorsese, because if I think about one American director who is a master of the soundtrack, the first person that comes to mind for me is Martin Scorsese. And I want to point in particular to one of his earliest films, Mean Streets, from 1973, which is one of my favorites of his. And that is a really early moment, but still a watershed moment in the development of how he approaches soundtracks. It's this really incredible combination of pop, things like the Rolling Stones, Jumpin' Jack Flash, or the Ronettes, Be My Baby, as well as Italian opera music. And it works together to create a kind of chronology of events. And there's one moment in particular that I absolutely love for illustrating how a particular song can create an entire experience for the audience. And that's when Harvey Keitel just gets absolutely blotto drunk in the bar, right? He's just absolutely wasted. And the way that we understand his state of mind is that this novelty doo-wop song called Rubber Biscuit by the Chips, it's this kind of manic, hysterical song, is playing. And it is because of how almost illegible that song is, how kind of fun but a little bit nauseating it is, that we're really put into the absolutely drunken state of mind of Harvey Keitel. It's an absolutely masterful integration of music and image.
There's Rubber Biscuit. Yeah, I could see that as a good illustrative drunk scene. Time for, I think, one more caller. How about Elizabeth in Oshkosh? Elizabeth, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Elizabeth?
I wanted to bring up Chariots of Fire, written by Vangelis from 1980, I think it was. When I first heard that song on the radio, I couldn't figure out what it was. I'm calling the radio station, you know, trying to figure out what this song is. Then I found out the movie. The movie was just great, and the movie actually won over a bunch of other bigger blockbuster movies. And I think the music theme, the whole score, had a lot to do with it.
Elizabeth, thanks a lot for the call. We're just about out of time. I'll see you a Vangelis Chariots of Fire and raise you a Vangelis Blade Runner soundtrack. Are there newer soundtracks, Jocelyn, with the Oscars around the corner? Anything that you are really enjoying these days, soundtrack-wise or score?
Yeah, absolutely. One of my favorite film scores right now is Micah Levy, who works under the name Mikachu. And Micah Levy is an experimental songwriter and composer who first kind of came on the scene with the score for the wonderful Jonathan Glazer film Under the Skin from 2014. And that film's about an alien played by Scarlett Johansson who comes to Earth. She comes to Glasgow and has to kind of figure out how to integrate amongst human beings. The score is so it's so strange, and it really puts us in this uncomfortable frame of mind where we too are experiencing how bizarre it would be to have these new perceptions, these human perceptions, when one has been an alien and never has experienced these things before. I think Mikachu is just incredible. They also did the score for Jackie in 2016, for Monos in 2019, and the upcoming film Zola, which I'm really excited for, which is finally coming out this year. So that's
we'll
really
to, We'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies from UW-Milwaukee. You can keep sharing your favorite movie music on the Ideas Network Facebook page. By the way, tomorrow on Central Time, we'll check out which Oscar nominees we ought to go out and see with Reggie, the real critic. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. A lot of people are getting vaccines these days, no secret there, but some people have had the chance to get them in cool places, like underneath a giant whale. Now, I got my first dose last week after some hullabaloo with my initial appointment canceled in the big pause. My scenic vaccine location, ground floor of a parking ramp. I'm not complaining. I was glad to get the shot, and they had a great system, never even had to get out of my car. But I am a little jealous of people who got theirs in more fun places. A lot of sports stadiums around the country and around the world have become vaccination sites, so a number of lucky Wisconsinites can say they got their shots at Lambeau Field, the frozen tundra. Okay, not actually on the field, as I understand it, but in the atrium. They probably don't want the liability from injuries sustained by vaccine recipients trying to do a Lambeau leap. Now, New York City has a new wrinkle. They announced this week the opening of a vaccine site at the American Museum of Natural History. There, people can get the vaccine right under the giant blue whale suspended from the ceiling. I've seen some pictures of the whale with a big bandage on its flipper. Is it worth the trip to New York just to get the shot under the whale? Probably not. To get my second shot at Lambeau? Maybe. But as of now, I'll stick with my scheduled parking structure for round two. Vax scenery news you can use. This is Central Time.